The story concerns a monastery that had fallen upon hard times. There were only 5 monks left, all over the age of 70. In the woods nearby was a little hut that a rabbi occasionally used for a hermitage. As he agonized over the imminent death of his order, it occurred to the abbot to visit the hermitage and ask the rabbi for advice that might save the monastery. The rabbi welcomed the abbot into his hut. But when the abbot explained the purpose of his visit, the rabbi could only commiserate with him. "I know how it is," he exclaimed. "The spirit has gone out of the people. It is the same in my town. Almost no one comes to the synagogue anymore." So the old abbot and the old rabbi wept together. The time came when the abbot had to leave. They embraced each other. "It had been a wonderful thing that we should meet after all these years," the abbot said. "But I still have failed in my purpose for coming here. Is there nothing you can tell me, no piece of advice that you can give me that would help me save my dying order?" "No, I'm sorry," the rabbi responded. "I have no advice to give. The only thing I can tell you is that the Messiah is one of you." When the abbot returned to the monastery, his fellow monks gathered around him to ask, "Well, what did the rabbi say?" "He couldn't help," the abbot answered. "The only thing that he did say, just as I was leaving, was something cryptic. It was that some of the Messiah was one of us. I don't know what he meant." In the days and weeks and months that followed, the old monks pondered this. "The Messiah is one of us? If that's the case, which one? Do you suppose he meant the abbot?" "Yes. If he meant anyone, he probably meant Father Abbot. He has been our leader for more than a generation. Well, on the other hand, he might have meant Brother Thomas. Certainly Brother Thomas is a holy man. Everyone knows that Thomas is a man of light. Certainly, he could have not meant Brother Eldred. But Eldred gets crotchety at times. But come to think of it, even though he's a thorn in people's sides, he's virtually right all the time. Often very right. Maybe the rabbi did mean Brother Eldred. Of course, the rabbi didn't mean me. Couldn't possibly have meant me. I'm just an ordinary person. Yet, supposing he did. Suppose I am the Messiah. Oh, God, not me. I couldn't be that much for you, could I?" As they contemplated this matter, the old monks began to treat each other with extraordinary respect, on the off chance that maybe one of them might be the Messiah, and on the off chance that the monk himself might be the Messiah, they began to treat themselves with extraordinary respect. Because the forest in which this was situated was beautiful, it so happened that people still occasionally came to visit the monastery. And as they did, without even being conscious of it, they sensed this aura of extraordinary respect that now began to surround the 5 monks and seemed to radiate out from them and permeate the atmosphere of the place. Then it happened that some of the younger men that came to visit the monastery started to talk more and more about the old monks with the old monks. After a while, one of them asked if he could join them, then another, and another. So within a few years, the monastery had once again become a thriving order and, thanks to the rabbi's gift, a vibrant center of light and spirituality in the realm.
And Scott Peck's story touches my heart deeply, because so often when we look at others, we look with an eye that is superficial and judgmental. We don't see the truth of who they are, nor do we see the truth of ourselves a lot of the time. Because there is that within us that shines, within every person, within every place, within every moment, there is a divinity that shines. We don't always see it. Sometimes we don't often see it. But it's always there. That is the foundation of the belief of Science of Mind, that the underlying nature of the universe is God. It's all made of God. Everything that you see is God in expression. And one time, when I was in meditation, I went to a place where whatever I thought manifested instantly. And I thought of light and this really wonderful antique Tiffany lamp with a chain appeared, and an invisible hand pulled the chain, and this light glowed from this gorgeous stained glass shade on this lamp. And then I thought of something scary, and a monster appeared. And in seeing that, I was frightened, and then I realized that I could choose love, even in the face of a monster. And as I said, I wonder what love would do here, the monster wandered away. It wasn't a part of my experience anymore. And in the inspiration of that moment, I thought, I wonder what God looks like in this place. And the eager young voice, sounding like a 8-year-old boy wanting to play, said to me, "What do you want me to be? What do you want me to be?" And that's how our lives are created. Whatever we focus on, whatever we think about, with our intention and attention, we are telling God what we want God to be today. So we get to focus on what we don't like and create more of that in the world, to feel disturbed and unpeaceful within ourselves. Or we get to focus on the essence of everyone, the light that is within them. Whether they are radiating light in our perception or not, they are light, and light they shall remain. There is no place we can go that is outside of God. But whether we perceive it or not is where we are perceiving from. Mm-hmm. The essence of who we are that Judy talked about when she said, "I feel peaceful. I feel a stillness within me." That is connecting with the essence of who we are. If we are connecting with the love that's within us, we are connecting with the essence of who we are. If we are connecting with the power that is within us, we are connecting with who we are. And that essence, that love, inspires us to take action in the world in different ways. But if we take action from love, we bring more love. If we take action from anger, we bring more anger. So if we can bring ourselves back into that place of stillness within ourselves, and then look at the world as the essence of love that is acting as the monster created by thought, or as the light created by thought, or as the technology created by thought, or as the political system created by thought, we can still look for the essence within that, whatever it is. I've told this story 100 times. People are probably tired of hearing this one, but I have new audience today, so I have someone new to tell it to. David Hawkins, who wrote a book called Power Versus Force, created something called the Map of Human Consciousness that describes consciousness from the level of shame and guilt all the way through fear and anger into neutrality and non-judgment and willingness and understanding and love and joy and ecstasy and bliss and oneness. And at one point he was talking about that map of human consciousness. He was standing there and he had it all written out on a graph next to him. And he gestured to it with a very casual gesture. And then he spoke in a way that almost made me fall off the couch. It was probably the most potent line anybody's ever delivered in my life. He gestured at the whole map and he said, "Of course it's all love. The anger, the fear, the shame, the guilt, the frustration, the violence is all love. In the expression of that individual, it's the highest love they know how to express in this moment. And they're coming from the intention of expressing love, even if their belief system seems twisted and inaccurate to us. for them, it is their expression of love. And if we, when he said that, I didn't see it. But seeing it through his eyes, suddenly I could see it. That when you feel victimized, to fight back and be angry is an expression of love. When you feel threatened, to defend what you believe in is an expression of love. To go forward with the intention to sacrifice yourself for your friends is an expression of love. To bring the peace that you are into a place and know that you can be peace there no matter what anyone else is doing with their expression of love is an expression of love. To look at everything that's happening from a place of oneness and say, the I am that I am is the I am that you are. And I choose to focus on the love that you are and the love that I am. And know that the differences between us are small. Is a way to look at the world from a place of extraordinary respect. Because every person there is absorbs the culture that they are brought up in. And some people have an incredible drive to learn and to grow. For some people, the achievement of greater enlightenment is the highest value that they hold. But as I was reading Power versus Force, David Hawkins said, every person in the world doesn't have the intention of enlightenment. I was shocked. Everybody I know wants to be enlightened. But that's law of attraction. Everybody isn't seeking enlightenment, but everybody is doing their best to express the love that they are, given the belief system and the understanding that they have. So if I am to be my objective, Judy and Gail and Peter and I went to a brainwave workshop last weekend where we were hooked up to an EEG machine and had our brainwaves measured in our meditation time. It was a powerful thing, and they asked us to set an intention for the weekend, and my intention that I came out with was to be the love I am more powerfully in the world. And that intention is reflected in my belief that the greatest thing we can do in the world is to vibrate that stillness of spirit within ourselves. That if we can stay in love, no matter what the conditions around us, we are doing something truly extraordinary. And that, for me, is my work. That's what I've chosen. That's what I'm called to do. That isn't everyone's work. Everyone's work is different. And each of us, in our own time of contemplation, our own seeking that divine spirit within us, we will find our own work. Some of us are working for organizations in political ways that further the causes that we believe in. Some of us are doing work in our own career that we believe is of service to others. Some of us are finding ways to live in the world that brings more love to our own lives first, because today we're struggling. And that's a good thing. When I was in Maine a couple of weeks ago, I kept listening to this song called When the Time Is Now by Carrie Cole. It's inspired by Course in Miracles. And the refrain goes, Spirit calls to us, if not now, then when? If not here, then where? If not you, then who will love your life? If not you, then who will love your life? To be in love in and as your life is the highest responsibility I think we own as individuals. To bring love, more love to our lives. Tolstoy said, I believe the reason of life is for each of us simply to grow in love. To grow in love, to love our lives, to love each other, to love someone, to love something, to find that love within us and allow it to flow somewhere is such a powerful thing. And if we're looking at something that keeps us from feeling the love that we are, maybe we need to look at something else until we feel our love flowing and then try to look back there and see what we can see from the filter of love rather than the filter of fear. That essence of love is everywhere. But if we're looking where we see it not, then we aren't connected with who we are. Abraham Hicks says their definition of unconditional love is staying connected to Source in spite of the conditions. And to find that love within us, that is the quality of God, that is the truth of all being. I firmly believe that. 11 years ago, when my husband died, the learning for me in that year, when I contemplated life and death and infinite life and the lack of death, but the state change of consciousness that we call death, I realized that if I were truly a lover of that man, of that person, my love had to be big enough to even transcend the conditions of physical bodies. It had to be big enough to transcend time and space entirely. And when we start to move into that space, the love that transcends time and space, we become more aware of the infinite nature of who we are already. We are eternal now. We're not eternal someday. And we have relationships that transcend time and space entirely. So if we begin to think of ourselves as transcendent beings beyond this physical life experience, it gives us the opportunity to look at life from that broader perspective. The Upanishads say something like, if you believe you can slay or be slain, you are mistaken. The truth of life is eternal, and the play of life is a expression of consciousness. And what we contribute to the world is our expression of consciousness. So if we give what we give with a blessing, if we give a smile, or if we give a check, or if we give a word, if we give ourselves with love, then we are influencing the consciousness of all humanity for all time. Ernest Holmes talked about, if you have a glass of dirty water, he was talking about our minds. If you have a glass of dirty water and you begin to pour clean water in it, it overflows and eventually the water in the glass is clean and clear. And if we add thoughts of love, wherever we can see love, we focus on that love, we are adding thoughts of love to the consciousness of humanity. We are putting love in. And more love comes out the more love we put in. The more practice we have, the easier it becomes to love. When I wrote my book, I thought about what I wanted as the dedication of my book. And I ended up focusing on the three men that I've lived with, my three husbands. The relationship that was incredibly painful that ended in divorce, the relationship that was filled with love and that ended in the death of my spouse, and the relationship with David. And in the book I said, I dedicate this material to my first husband, who helped me learn to love myself, because I learned that living his agenda wasn't going to work for me, and that if I was going to live my own life, I had to separate from him. My second husband taught me how to love another with kindness and caring. And David, I see David's role as teaching me to be love. Because David's love is expansive and extraordinary. David was taught to love by his parents in a profound way. He's shared with me recently a letter that his ex-wife sent him that his father had written him at one time when he moved to California and was separated from the family for the first time in his life. And his father wrote him 4 pages, handwritten pages of love. It was extraordinary. He talked about how proud he was of him and how much he loved him and how graceful he saw his life unfolding. And the modeling of love David received in his life was amazing. I don't remember my father ever telling me he loved me. And to see that, I knew he did, but he couldn't say it. And so to see that outpouring of love from Aaron Gordon to David made me cry. Because it is so powerful to express the love that you are. To be able to bring it into the world and express it to the people that you care about is an extraordinary thing. David, one morning, we were just talking and he said something about Reverend Hillary. He said, "Reverend Hillary is that part of me that desires freedom and loves to be out traveling the world, making connections with people." And I said, "What did you say?" And he said, "Well, that's that part of me that she is." And I said, "Tell me more." And he said, "Well, Kate is that part of me that faces life with laughter and courage." And I started listing people in our lives. And he told me 10, 12, 14, 16 people who that person was for him. He or she is that part of me that. And I was just stunned by that capability and open-heartedness that David had, that not only could he see the very best in all of these people, he was able to characterize people in a way that I never would have been able to articulate. And it came so naturally to him. It was just part of who he was. And when you say, "This person is that part of me that," you're not speaking from your local perspective. You're speaking from your infinite perspective, where the I am that I am is the I am that you are is the I am that you are. To be able to be so clearly in that universal perspective that you can see the beauty, the godliness, the love in others is a really profound place to live. And I am so grateful to David and his family for modeling love like that in my universe. It's a remarkable thing to be able to see that light in other people and to focus that clearly. Abraham Hicks has a process they call Book of Positive Aspects. And what they recommend is that you get out a notebook and on every page put the name of an individual. And on that page write everything that you see in that person that is of the highest expression of who they are. So that as you think about them, you focus more and more on the greatest connection that they exhibit in their lives. The moments you see the blessing in them, you capture it and you write it down. You see them being generous to a child or smiling at someone, giving a dollar to someone on the street because you feel abundant and loving. That essence of who you are reflects that essence of who they are, and then when you see them, that's what you think of them. You draw forth the very best of who they are. It's easy to focus on the worst of who anybody is. But one time Ernest Holmes said, we need to let go of our petty blessedness as well as our petty flaws. The giving ourselves credit for being good isn't really valid because we're intrinsically good. Knowing our intrinsic goodness and then expressing that intrinsic goodness is so much more powerful than seeing the surfaceness of ourselves and others. Jesus said, "This is my beloved Son." Here's the way Ernest Holmes said it. Back of the conflict of ideas, back of the din of external life and action, back in the innermost recesses of uplifted thought, in silent contemplation, there is a voice ever proclaiming, "This is my beloved Son." Seldom does this voice penetrate the outer world of human experience. Seldom does anyone allow it to perfectly express through him. We must learn to listen for this voice. Call it conscience, intuition, or what we will, it is there. No one need go unguided through life, for all are divine at the center, and all are images of the Most High. So when we look at anyone else, or when we look at ourselves, if we can look for the beloved son or daughter, if we can look for the Messiah, if we can see the love in the expression, even if we would judge the expression as wrong or misguided, we can stay in the love as the love that we are. I don't know anybody who can do it all the time. But to do it one more time today than I did yesterday is a powerful way to change my life. And it's not about guiding action from a set of rules or a list from the outside. I can't tell anyone what they should do in the world. All I can say is there is that within them that knows. And if they come from their love, their action will always be the most exquisite action they can take. And so when I am tempted to judge another, I look for the truth of their being rather than the focus of their attention in this moment. For they may be focused somewhere other than love, but the truth of who they are is love. And that's as unconditional as I know how to be today. Thanks.